Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is John Jennings, who's the VP of Sales and Marketing and one of the founders of Royer Labs. But first, let's talk about what's in the news, and a big thing today is Apple asks the major labels for a discount. Yes, Apple isn't happy with the license deal that it has with the major labels, so it's going back and looking to get a big discount. How big? Well, big enough that it can lower the price for Beats Music from $9.99 a month down to $4.99. There's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, Pandora is $4.99, although they only have about 3.5 million paying subscribers, so you can't say price has been a big thing for them. That being said, Spotify now has a new family plan, and the family plan basically means that the very first subscription is $9.99, and any member of your family is $4.99 thereafter. Is that going to make a difference in Spotify? Well, it's a little too early because they just announced it last week, so we can't really tell how influential that's going to be in getting new people to sign up. That being said, we know that iTunes is going to relaunch Beats Music next year, or at least that's the word, and they want to launch with a lower price. Good luck getting the major labels convinced that they should lower the prices. They already feel that they've been taken advantage of, and it will probably be a real cold day in hell before they lower those prices, unless Apple really makes a great case for it, which I think is going to be a very, very tough go for Apple at this point. The major labels really need a big, big convincing that this is something that they should do. With iTunes sales down 14% this year and dropping like a rock, Apple knows it has to do something. The future is in streaming, and they want to make sure they can get as many of the 550 million credit card users that they have in file. They can get those people right away with Beats Music when they relaunch next year. So we'll see if this works or not. I'm not sure that just lowering the price will work. Already people say that even at $9.99, a lot of people are going to sign up for the next iteration of Beats Music as soon as Apple makes the big push. I'm not so sure that they need to do this, but if they do, $4.99 is certainly attractive. Is it attractive enough for people to go that way? We'll soon see. The next thing I want to talk about is the products that the musical instrument industry and the pro audio industry got right. You always hear about products that are kind of off the mark and products that are outdated within a very short period of time, but there's a lot of products, and some that we use every day, that have been around for a long time, that were hits out of the box or shortly thereafter and continue to be till this day. Number one, the Shure SM57, SM58. This is a product that's been going on for 50 years plus, and still people use this every day and they still buy it every day. There may be a new version in the beta versions, but the old SM57, SM58 still has a lot of life to it. That's a product that certainly they got right. Number two, the Ampeg SVT. Has there ever been a better bass amp? If you really want low end, if you really want it to be loud, if you really want to shake the stadium, this is the bass amp to beat all bass amps. Number three, the Marshall 1960 slant cabinet. Has there ever been a better guitar cabinet? I don't think so. It's the standard. Of course, now Marshall makes several different models, but only the Birch one. The ones using Birch are the ones that are the iconic ones with the iconic sound. Of course, the speakers mean a lot. The 25-watt Celestions are the ones that everybody likes. That being said, that particular model, the 1960, is the one that's still being used everywhere, and wow, it's been a long time. Number four, the Fender Strat. Some people say it's the perfect guitar. It feels good in the body. It sounds good. Has a lot of different sounds. It has a tremolo, and that was the first tremolo bar. Has there ever been a better guitar? Number five, the Fender P-Bass. And again, has there ever been a better bass? Have you ever used something that sounded better on a recording? The Fender P-Bass is still the go-to bass for so many different studio musicians. Live, they may play something else in the studio. There's always a dependable P-Bass that they're going to use. Number six, the K&M Boom Stand. And again, it's something that we use every day. The K&M is still the best. There's a lot of them that have been made by other manufacturers, but no one has managed to do it better than the K&M Boom Stand. Number seven, this is kind of a catch-all, it's powered monitors. If you go back to the old days when we had to match amplifiers with speakers, it was a giant pain. Just trying to find something that actually worked in combination with your speakers, trying to find a combination of amplifier and speakers, that took a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it cost a lot more money than powered speakers do now. So this was a revelation. This was something that was really great, and we're all happy that that's one of the things that they got right. Number 8, the digital audio workstation. And once again, people are nostalgic for tape, but I'll tell you what, there's nothing better than a DAW. Because they work great, they give you as many tracks as you want for the most part. They give you all sorts of power and all sorts of versatility that we never had in the tape days. Number 9, the Dean Jensen Direct Box design. This is the iconic direct box design that Dean Jensen came up with based around his transformer that really changed everything in the studio. There's been others, but this has been the one that everybody has gone to ever since. Dean Jensen, of course, makes transformers, but so many people were using it for direct boxes that he came up with kind of the ultimate design. And it's very simple, it's very easy to use. And Radial Engineering now makes a great version called the JDI that's kind of like the standard in the studio anymore. Number 10, the ribbon mic. And of course, there's been a lot of great ribbon mics. One of the best is by Royer Labs, and we're going to speak to somebody who's going to tell us a lot about them and John Jennings in a little bit. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. That's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is John Jennings, who's the VP of Sales and Marketing and one of the founders of Royer Labs. In many ways, he's responsible for putting Royer on the map, making the studio standard for guitar amps. And I spoke to him via Skype from his home in Nashville. So, John, thanks so much for being with me, my inner circle. It's so great to have you. I've been wanting to do this with you for quite a while, and I'm glad we finally got together.
Yeah, me too. Thanks a lot, Bobby. You've been a friend for years, and I'm so glad to be on the show finally.
You know, it's funny because when we talked about this at AES, I mentioned I wanted to talk to you about playing guitar and about your background as a guitar player. And I don't remember who was with this, but somebody said, oh, do you play guitar? I didn't know that. And it's rampant in our business that people don't know our backgrounds. And most of our backgrounds are as players, and unfortunately they know us as, you know, something else that we are in the industry. So I want to start there. I want to talk about your playing. So tell me about your playing days.
Well, first, interestingly, I think that people need to understand people's background as musicians really informs the decisions we make as we get into pro audio and recording and how much we really love it and what it means to us. I mean, people who aren't players, maybe you come in with a business degree, definitely have a important roles, but if you understand music and you really have a feel for it from playing and practicing and falling in love with instruments and things, you really love what we're doing here and these tools that we discover that help make music better mean so much to us. So my background as a player, I mean, I started playing drums when I was, I think, 10, piano when I was 8. And picked up the guitar at 11, and that was all she wrote. I mean, learned those first 4 chords, played a few songs with them, thought it was the coolest thing ever, and never looked back. You know, I was definitely going to be a rock and roll musician, and got a little Harmony Rocket when I was 12 in a Gibson amplifier.
Still have them?
I wish. Yeah. No, I tore that Harmony apart when I was 13 and refinished it, you know, brown, and then put it back together and played around with it a lot. And then later got I think when I was 14 and got a Telecaster thin line, you know, the semi-hollow body ones.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that I think I let somebody have the Rocket. I wish I still had it.
Yeah.
And I've got old photos of it. But
So you, like the rest of us, you played in bands in high school then, I guess, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny is I had a high school band that really became quite good when I think I was 15 when we put it together. And by the time, you know, the summer, I think, of my sophomore year, we were playing all the local clubs. And, you know, we were all underage except for the keyboard player. and none of the club owners knew it because we were drawing some pretty good crowds. We were playing the Allman Brothers and Marshall Tucker and, you know, Doobie Brothers and the songs that were popular then in the mid late '70s. But we were also playing George Benson and John Trope and some really great like dance music.
Wow.
And Clarence Clemons lived in our town, you know, the saxophone player for Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
And he used to come down and jam with us. So, you know, we'd be playing and we had good crowds for that time.
Where was this at?
This was in the Asbury Park area.
Is that where you're from?
Yeah, Jersey, man.
I had no idea. I lived in Asbury Park.
No way. You did? I didn't know that.
Well, I didn't grow up there, but I moved there. I think in the early 70s, I was there. And I used to play, my band used to play in the Stone Pony all the time. And Bruce used to come and all the East Streeters would come and sit in. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. A small world.
I played the Pony too. I played it. I played the Pony regularly on Wednesdays. Like in, it would have been maybe 79 or 80. And with a band called Sure Shot.
Okay. I was gone by then.
Coming around then, were you?
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, it's a small world. Geez, I had no idea. So where was the town in Jersey then that you grew up in?
Well, let's see. It was a town called Rumson.
Oh, of course. I know Rumson, yeah.
Yeah. And we were literally two blocks from the bridge that went over to Seabright. You know, I used to hop off that bridge in the summertime.
Yeah.
But Seabright was a really happening town. There was Tradewinds there and a number of other clubs. We played the Tradewinds and a lot of these different places. And, you know, then we'd pull, you know, we'd play in Red Bank and you know, Fairhaven and those towns. But we'd pull 70 or 80, sometimes 100 or more crowds and, you know, people crowds and play some, you know, some good funky dance music and the rock that was happening then. And, yeah, I had a great time. I think the club owners just figured we were all old enough because of the kind of crowds that were coming in.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably a third of the crowds were people with fake ID. You know, coming in. That's how we all rolled back then.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened from there?
Well, let's see. From there, I moved out to California, then, Oregon and just, you know, was playing in some local bands, moved to Philly. And ended up playing in a couple of different bands there, a Rasta band called Sons of Ace, which I loved, and then another band called The Reach, which was kind of a pop rock band. And,
wow.
You know, we got some plays and video play and some radio play in that area.
Well, I grew up in Pennsylvania near Philly. Again, you know, it's funny. This is why I always say, you never know somebody until you interview them. We've known each other for years, and I never knew that about you, and probably you didn't know that about me either.
No clue.
Yeah.
It sounds like I was following in your footsteps there, you know, Pennsylvania and Asbury just coming right up behind you.
Yeah, right. So, okay, so you're in Philly, and how do you get back to California?
Well, I was in Philly and doing some session work there. Not a lot, but mostly, you know, I had a lot of musician friends, bands, and I'd go in and lay down parts for them. And sometimes it was paid, sometimes it was free, and I'd go lay down parts, and my band recorded some then. But I was kind of a tone freak, and so I had some pretty sweet tones to deliver, you know, to recordings, and I could always come up with parts that were maybe a little different. You know how it is when you sit down and you jam with somebody, you jam through a song, you end up finding a part that a producer goes, oh, now can you just play that thing over and over?
Yeah.
Sure. Right. You know, and you play that and you leave and everybody's happy. But I had this, in California and Oregon, I had this Tremolux head, Fender Tremolux. I think it was a 63 and a 210 cabinet. And the thing sounded so beautiful. It was just the most beautiful thing to lay into with a cord. A little MXR flanger, maybe just get a slight chorus thing and some. I had an Echoplex tape device, which I bought when I was 19 in San Francisco from this store manager, this big, tall guy who was very enthusiastic, sold this thing to me. And I met him years later when he was running Groove Tubes. It was Aspen Pittman.
Oh.
But that and a couple of good distortion pedals, and man, could you get things bouncing around. I mean, what a beautiful tone that was. And I've spent my whole life chasing tone. It's all about Yeah, you start there, and you know, of course, your playing is really important. You've got to play, and but the tone is elusive and beautiful, and that's why I got so into ribbons later, because you know I could never capture that tone. Recording was always such a disappointment to me. We're always chasing, at best, an approximation of the sound that you went into, or that you brought into the studio with you. And then I remember once on a session with a pretty fine engineer in a good studio, we just weren't getting a guitar sound. And I ended up, you know, the amp sounded great, but we just weren't getting it. And I ended up plugging into a RAT distortion pedal and an MXR compressor and going directly into the console. And we got a better sound than we were getting miking that cabinet up.
Wow.
You know, and this wasn't a slack engineer. It just wasn't his night or something, or wasn't mine. But we got our parts that way. And they sounded good in the mix, but we were missing the whole beautiful thing that was coming out of that amplifier. And that's happened so many times, that when it dawned on me what ribbons were capable of, and that they could really capture all that sound, like the whole thing, top to bottom, it just blew my mind.
Well, tell me the... what led to that epiphany?
Well, I had a company with Dave Royer in 1996 that didn't work out. We were making his tube condensers and preamplifiers and compressors, some really good gear. But, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. And, you know, Dave was hand-building most of the gear. And it just, you know, that one didn't work out. But during that time, Dave was always talking about ribbon mics. And he was saying, you know, well, I really want to do ribbons because they're so natural, and all these different mics are just not quite getting it. And, you know, he loves his condensers too, but he was really kind of ribbon crazy, and I didn't care, and neither did anybody else. But one day in the office, I read an article by, it was an interview of Eddie Kramer. And Eddie was saying that he always had at least one ribbon on Jimi Hendrix's cabinet in the studio, along with other mics. He was a mic combiner.
Yeah.
But that just, that lit every fuse in me. Like, whoa. This, what do you mean he had a ribbon on there? And then that night on the way home, I turned on the radio just on top of that great riff in Third Stone from the Sun. Blah, blah, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And it was like a religious experience. I remember exactly where I was and the turn I was making onto the 101. And I thought, wow, ribbons have something to do with all that. You know, and I went in the next day and started talking with Dave about ribbons, you know, and he knew so much and he had so much to say about just ribbons and tone and how they came together, that's sort of what started the conversation that ultimately led to Royer Labs in 98.
So there's like a 2 or 3 year run up to Royer Labs then, right?
Yeah, it was 96 where we're really trying this first company. It was called DVA. That didn't pan out, but during that time, we started the ribbon discussion. In 97, DVA closed early in the year, and we were, you know, Dave was building custom mics in Fullerton where he lives, and I had met this fellow named Rick Parada, and Rick is the president of Royer Labs now.
Yeah,
and Rick's production chops and his ability to start and run companies is superb. So it was Rick's involvement that when Dave produced his original prototype of the 121, you know, we all got together and said, wow, now we've got something. This is pretty cool. Took it out and did some testing with the mic. And that was, I think that was late 97. So maybe September or so of 97. And actually, that first mic went to Joe Barisi.
Oh, no kidding.
He was recording this unknown band at the time, and that was this little unknown, funny-looking mic with those ears and had a captive cable on it. And so that mic became the R-121, and that band became Queens of the Stone Age. And Joe actually went back to one of the original recordings back then, and we listened to the isolated 121 tracks, you know, that first mic, yeah, which was just mind-blowing. It was great. Joe's a wonderful guy and, you know, such a great engineer. It's cool to listen to what things sounded like and, you know,
okay,
what that mic brought to the record.
So you started Royer and you went to Joe and you found out that, okay, this is going to work. And then you went into manufacturing. But I know that you were the guy behind really putting Royer on the map in terms of taking it around to guys like Joe Barisi and taking it to all the studios and hipping everybody to it. And it was your ceaseless effort that really put Royer on the map.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
And what I want to know is, how did all this happen? Because did you know all those guys before, or were you just cold calling, or how did that happen?
Well, a couple of things happened. I met some of them when we were doing DVA. And interestingly, the only guy in the press who would even really talk to me or give me the time of day back then, because we didn't know anybody, he came by and listened to our gear and then gave me a lot of advice, was George Peterson, who was the editor of Mix at that point.
Yeah,
wonderful guy, and he still is. And even in Royer's early days, he gave me advice on how to structure our advertisements and the layout being a microphone and so forth. And we use that advice to this day. So George was helpful in making some connections. And Rick Parada, the president of Royer, and our other business partner, Rafael Viafane, had a studio in the 80s called Babio.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, pretty cool place.
Yeah.
Recorded a lot of good bands there. And so they knew Ed Cherney, and Ed was a friend. And Ed actually gave us our very first quote, tried the mic out, liked it, gave us a nice quote. And of course, that opened some doors. So I was calling people, and Dave Royer knew Joe Barisi, so he made that introduction, and I met Joe. And then as people were trying the mics out, they started introducing us to other folks. And I cold called a lot of people. I cold called studios. I cold called engineers. But what I found was, really, we have such a friendly industry. If you call and you're just cool and, you know, you say, look, I love your work, and, you know, and you've got to do a little research first, know who you're calling.
Yeah.
Understand what they're doing and say, look, I've got a mic I'd really like you to try out. It's a new thing. We're getting into these ribbons. And people were so open-minded and into trying this new thing out, this 121. And we had a stereo SF-12 in the early days too. So yeah, lots of cold calling, but a lot of recommendations from Ed and Joe and different people. And then Jerry Hay, you know, the great, trumpet player, Jerry Hay and Gary Grant. They're really the nucleus of that Jerry Hay section, that team, and Rick Baptist and Wayne Bergeron and a lot of the trumpet guys. They came into the shop one day in our very early days and literally bought us out of mics. You know, that was a point where we had a couple dealers and we were selling it directly to some local players, and, you know, which we don't do anymore, but they came in and just were waving credit cards to cash and bought all these mics. And then they started spreading the word. So the phone calls were coming in even more than they were going out from different people. Hey, you know, man, we heard this thing that Jerry brought in and Gary's raving and, you know, I got to try this. There was a great network of LA musicians and engineers who got excited quickly and then spread the word, and it was all we could do to keep up with it. But almost every day I was in a different studio setting mics up or delivering them or meeting people and, you know, teaching them what the mics can do.
One of the things that I think you probably had going for you is the fact that the only ribbon mic that really was available was one of the RCAs at the time. And there wasn't a lot of those around, but the people that knew how cool they are really hungered for something new. And, there's some serendipity there, right place, right time. But obviously you had a better product, or you had a product that was as good, but more reliable, much more rugged. No, it was the right product for the right time.
It really was. It was pretty amazing. I mean, it was, instead of being a big, heavy, fragile microphone, which ribbons were up to that point, there were a couple that weren't quite so big. The Biodynamic M160, which is the one that Eddie was talking about when he used it on Jimmy's cabinet.
Yeah.
Somewhat limited in terms of frequency response because of its the way it's modified to create a cardioid pattern, but a cool mic in its own right. And that mic and the Kohl's 4038 were still being manufactured. But they, you know, Kohl's, it's a wonderful sounding mic, but it'll fly apart if you look at it the wrong way.
Yeah.
So.
And not easy to get, too. Not easy to get over here.
No. I mean, you can find them, but, and then you can find some of the old RCAs, but they've become quite valuable now.
Yeah.
And Wes Dooley with AEA makes a wonderful recreation of the RCA 44 and 77. And then he's gone on to build a number of other models, you know, based on that sort of classic technology. But what happened with Royer is Dave Royer designed this mic that was fairly small and sleek and had a really nice mid-range. I mean, he always says music lives in the mids. And, you know, the low end and the high end were you know, very true and all there, but it wasn't one of those smiley face kind of curves that you get with a lot of mics with big low end. And, you know, with ribbons, you don't particularly get a lot of highs, but you could EQ that in. But with the 121 and the SF-12, you had a beautiful mid-range response, which was part of what set it apart as a ribbon microphone. But you also had something that Rick Parada did, and that's with ribbons, you literally run the ribbon element through a set of gears to give it that shape. If the ribbon is it's a very thin piece of aluminum foil, basically very thin, like, you know, 2.5 microns in the 121. You'd have to stack up, what, 40 or 50 of those to get to the width of a human hair. And if it'll literally float in the air if the wind's blowing outside and you've got a static electricity buildup. I've seen them float off our benches and stick to the ceiling, and later during the day they come down, you know. But what Rick did is in the old days, and really what everybody does is you take this ribbon element, you put glassine paper on two sides and run it through a set of gears. And then you get sort of a wavy corrugated pattern, which allows it to move and flex sort of like a slinky. But what Rick did is he designed these corrugators. They run us about $6,000 a pop. And these are $2,000 gears on there. They're cut absolutely perfectly. And then you've got these micrometer adjustments, and it's got to be at a certain temperature. But you can run the ribbons through these corrugators with no glassine paper. And they take the shape of the gear. You work harden the metal on its way over the gears, which makes it tougher. And we ended up with a ribbon. We didn't realize how tough it was. I mean, our original spec, and it's still our spec, says minus SPL levels of 135 dB. And that's at like 40 hertz. I mean, that's pretty low. That's a lot of power. It'll take more than that, though. And it's because of that direct corrugated ribbon element that you put it in there and clamp it at the top and the bottom. And it, you know, wind can blow it, but it would take phenomenal SPLs to really damage that ribbon. So some engineers were putting it right up tight on guitar cabinets. And at first it scared me. I remember the first time I saw it was on a little deluxe, and I'm going, it was on an Alanis Morissette session. And I'm going, oh, I don't know about that, man. That's scary. The engineer's like, no, man, we do this. It sounds great. And then, I mean, it went from that to working with Ross Hogarth, who's done a lot of work with us over the years, tons of work. And I've seen it up on 120 watt wide open Rivera with a guitar detuned to God knows what, close 2 inches from the cabinet. And it literally makes you physically sick. I stood out there for a moment and went, oh my God, I got to leave. I'm going to be like destroyed. And the mic took it just fine. But, you know, give it to a 2-year-old and let them blow through it, and you're gonna need to get it re-ribboned.
Yeah.
So they hate air, but they don't mind SPLs. And that was wasn't designed to be that tough, but it was designed to be tough. It's just it was kind of a nice surprise for us all to see how much it could withstand. You know, Joe Perry had six of them on his cabinet from I think 2001 right on through now on his live cabinets, and they only blew one, and it was. And that mic had been dropped and it done some rolling and hadn't been handled really well. But they've only blown one ribbon in that entire time, which is a pretty good track record.
No kidding.
Especially Joe's crazy loud amps. Yeah. They send them in every couple of years, and if they're getting a little loose, we'll re-ribbon them. But, you know, they would have hung in there for quite a few more years if we hadn't re-ribboned them.
Digressing to Eddie Kramer for a second, I was lucky enough to do some sessions with him as a guitar player where he mic'd my gear.
Wow.
So
I'm going to interview you. I need to know more about your playing, man, for Eddie to call you in.
Well, I'm just an owner now. I own gear. I don't play it.
Me too these days.
But his trick was he had three microphones all stuck together. One was a 57, 421, and Beyer M160. And then about 3 feet back from the cabinet, he would have a 67 or an 87, whatever was available. Mm-hmm. And then about 10 feet back, he had a stereo mic. And again, it was whatever was available. But his real secret sauce was he had to have a real plate. And he would actually lay that plate down. He'd record the plate as well. But to see him record is pretty amazing because he doesn't just set the faders and say, oh, that sounds good, and leave. He's constantly balancing. What he's doing is a performance as well as the performance. So he's balancing the inputs from the mics, which is 3, 4, 5, 6 inputs from the mics plus the 2 stereo for the plate. So there's 8 faders that are in constant motion while he's doing it. It's pretty amazing, actually, to watch him do that.
Yeah, Eddie's amazing. Eddie's one of the most energetic guys I've ever met. Yeah. He is so enthusiastic about what he does. I was at NRG with him when he was remastering Woodstock for 5-1. And he had the original tapes there. It was incredible. And I got to air guitar Purple Haze with him and the Star Spangled Banner. And this guy's air guitaring like any teenager who's really jacked up. So much energy, so much enthusiasm. And I realized, I've known him for years now. This guy loves music and he's so enthusiastic about things he's into. It makes total sense that he's sitting there riding those faders and creating sound as it goes. And that's, I'm sure, that's got so much to do with Hendrix's, incredible recordings.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But, again, when you think about it, it's a good way to capture the sound of a guitar because, as we know, it's very difficult for one microphone to do it. Although, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it with an R121 or any of that breed. But if you don't have that, you have to use multiple mics. And when you think about what he did and what the setup is, it kind of makes sense that, he can get that big sound. He can capture it because he's using layers of microphones, which, makes a lot of sense.
It does because things sound different. I mean, a cabinet is different at 4 feet at it than it is right up there up close.
Yeah.
I really like the sound of a cab a few feet back.
Yeah, me too.
Developing some different things. And it's a great place to put a mic.
Yeah.
Some great recordings were done with just a condenser stuck back 4 or 5 feet from an amplifier. And, of course, that really immediate thing you get right at the speaker is pretty fantastic, too.
Yeah.
So, and that's a sound we've all gotten used to. So, I mean, you can get a lot of great stuff right there. But, having a mic a little further back is always kind of cool.
Back to Royer's for a second. So, Royer microphones work so well in so many different places. Where don't they work?
Huh. Well, they don't work right up on a kick drum. Particularly in that little port, you cut the stick of microphone through.
Yeah.
The air will give you one great hit and then it's all over. But they do work on kicks back about 8 inches to 10 inches if you lean them forward at 45 degrees. You distribute that very large sound wave down the length of the ribbon. You don't smack it all at once in the center. To our ears, it sounds like just one big massive kick drum hit, which is wonderful. But it's literally physically, it's not hitting the ribbon the same way. And I've seen them last for years in that position. They don't work outside without good wind protection. We've built these mic socks that all the mics come with that you can literally just leave those on the mic. They barely change the tone at all, but they really do protect the mics well from wind.
Really? I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. I've been on a lot of outdoor gigs and told engineers, cause I try to get to a lot of gigs and studios, and I told guys, hey, just throw your mic sock on. You don't worry about the big furry thing or this and that. Just throw the sock on and leave it. You won't even hear it, but you'll keep that wind from blowing through. I was on something Carrie Underwood did a few years ago for TV, and it was outside, out back one of the studios where they've got the stage and a live audience, and it was kind of windy, and they had an SF-24 on the drum overhead. So we just put the windsock on. They said, "Well, will you take care of this if anything happens?" I said, "Sure." I've seen this so many times, and they left the windsock on. It sounded great, and the mic was fine.
Wow. Okay.
But as far as where they don't work, It's interesting. You can make them work for almost anything. Where they really work is when you're trying to capture the sound of the instrument the way it is in the room. So if you've got a guitar amp or percussion device or a trumpet or anything that you really like the sound of, the way it is, ribbons, good ribbons will really help get you there. But sometimes sometimes you want to change that sound. Let's say you've got a really woolly sounding tambourine, but you want it to cut through the mix more. You throw up a good condenser. You throw up something that's brighter, or on a lead poppy vocal. I love ribbons on vocals, and what most people don't realize is they take EQ beautifully. You can open up a lot of 12K and get things to air out. I'll give you a great example. Sixpence None the Richer, the engineer is a friend of mine, Russ Long.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you know Russ.
Yeah.
Another great guy, and he's also a regular contributor to Pro Audio Review and some other magazines. And Russ was recording Sixpence None the Richer. And he was recording Kiss Me and There She Goes Again, which were two huge hits. But she was so sibilant on these microphones, nothing was working. All his best condensers were just folding. Everything sounded too sibilant and harsh. So he put up a Coles 4038, put up good pop filter on it, and opened up 12K by 5 or 6 dB. And then put another little bump somewhere in the highs to approximate the response of a condenser microphone. And they're wonderful sounding pop vocal tracks. Sounds like she's on the sweetest condenser in the world, but you can't get a ribbon to go sibilant. So yeah. I wouldn't throw one up flat for a pop vocal. I've heard it on some Robert Cray and different singers for really nice blues vocals and things. But I have heard some EQ'd pop vocals on ribbons that are wonderful. So if you don't mind throwing some EQ on a ribbon, you can get a really nice response. And in particularly on a woman's voice that could be sibilant on a mic, you can approximate the sound of a condenser, but not deal with the harshness or sibilance of a condenser.
How far away from the microphone, we'll just say an R121, do you suggest the vocalist be?
Depends on the singer. Definitely put a pop filter on it and add 2 to 3 inches from where you would like the singer on a condenser. The condenser likes to eat it, or if the singer likes to eat a condenser, get in, from a couple inches or so, put another 2 to 3 inches between the mic and that person.
That surprises me, because I would have thought it would have been farther back in order to protect the ribbon.
That's why I'm talking about the pop filter.
Yeah, okay.
You want that pop filter on it. A good pop filter will keep the air from getting to the ribbon and still give you that very immediate sound if you want a singer that close. That tight, you're going to end up with some proximity effect too. So you're probably going to want to engage a high pass filter and just roll off things from, 100, 120 and below, depending on what you're looking for in the singer. The nice thing is that also removes anything else that might be rumbling in the room, from 100 or 120 hertz below.
Yeah. Out of all of the Royer microphones, and there's quite a lot in the line now, right?
Yeah.
How many mics is it? About eight? Something like that? Eight or nine?
It's eight. It's eight. And then there's the live versions, which bring us to 10.
Which is your favorite?
Oh, man. My overall favorite is probably the 122V. It is the tube version of the 122. The 122 is the phantom-powered version of the 121. The reason I say that is it has the tube circuit that they've designed is just gorgeous, and it sort of adds this dimensionality. Dusty Wakeman put it so well. He goes, "Well, it's like a 122, but you sprinkle fairy dust on it."
Doesn't that get you to the point?
Yes, and it's funny. I was on an Eddie Kramer mixing date once, just hanging out at the studio, and he was recording this band. I think they were from Sweden, or he was mixing them, and he had recorded a lot of their stuff at Dusty's studio, Mad Dog.
Yeah.
And this one guitar was just like, man, what did you do? Thing's amazing. It was a Buddha and a Les Paul and these certain effects. And he goes, oh, yes, I have that valve mic on there. He had the 122V, actually one of the very early ones, before we'd released the mic. And And it made so much sense because there was a sense of dimension in it that I just hadn't, that stood out to me. It's dimension, and it also handles SPLs, you know, handles the kind of SPLs that a 121 does beautifully. So you can use it on, you know, heavy rock stuff. It was the main mic that Eddie Van Halen cut his last, you know, record on, with Ross Hogarth cutting all the guitars on that mic. But Alan Myerson, a great scoring engineer for Hans Zimmer and a number of other composers, uses them in a number of different positions. He's got 5 122Vs. They're on the Decatree and woodwind overheads and violins and horns and all sorts of different stuff.
The Decatree, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah, not all the time. It's an interesting thing, but I know he's tried it a few times, and there's some photos on Royer's site of website of when he was scoring Pirates of the Caribbean. And he had 3 122Vs on the Decatree.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Considering that there's so few microphones that work in a Decatree, that's pretty amazing.
It is. It really is. And I don't know how heavily they factored in the mix, but I know that, you know, he's tried them on a lot of different applications. And that Decatree application, I know he's used it at least a few times over the years.
Wow. That's very impressive, John. Let's circle back to guitars and amplifiers again.
I love it.
Okay, so what's your favorite setup?
Oh, man.
What's the favorite setup that you have?
To be honest with you, I have kind of funny. One of my favorites is I was working with a band in L.A., and I remember walking out of rehearsal one time, and I saw this head sitting in the backyard in the rain. Because that's back when it was raining in L.A. Right now, I haven't done that in a long time. But I see this thing, and I walked over, and I was like, you using this? Nah. So I'll give you $50. Sure. Well, it was a 1964 Blackface Basement.
Oh, come on.
No, for real.
I have one as well, and I got to tell you, it's wonderful. But I didn't buy mine out of the rain for $50.
Well, I took it over to, do you remember Red Rhodes?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Red was a Groove Tube designer, great, great amp guy, great pedal steel player.
Yeah.
Very famous in the day. And Red tweaked it a bit. Put some new power tubes in and the first stage pre-tube, tweaked it a little and sent it on its way. And another guy, I think his name is Dave Friedman, put a master in it for me and sort of messed around with it a little bit to make it a bit more versatile. I know that's a little sacrilege to some folks, but what a wonderful head. I do love that. I think my favorite for just sitting back and playing on is really a modified JCM 800 that I have. Mm. It was Brad Gillis's back in the Ozzy days, and he used it on Night Ranger and stuff. And then I had a John Shore clean channel built into it as well, with some switching and an effects loop put in, and by a guy who did a wonderful job on it. And it's such a versatile and fun amp to play with that it's just great for writing. Low volume sounds great, high volume sounds great. And it just picked up a head that I'm playing on every day now, just getting to know. It's a Metropolis.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Fellow named George Metropolis makes these Metropolis heads, hand wires them. They're based on Plexi heads and older Marshall heads, and absolutely wonderful. I plugged it in, and there's just all that really nice, chimey, ballsy sort of stuff going on, and I've been having a blast with that.
Yeah, sounds like fun. I had a JCM 800 as well that was great, a white one that was stolen out of the studio, and it hurts me till this day every time I think about it, because it was a wonderful sounding amplifier. But anyway, so guitars, favorite guitar that you own, favorite guitar overall.
Well, I've got a few favorites. I've got one that I picked up a couple years ago, brand new, and I don't usually buy new guitars. I like to buy them used, and you really see what direction they're heading in, and they've developed some. But Martin put out 120 of these 12-string baritone guitars called the Pete Seeger model.
Baritone 12-string, wow.
12-string. Yeah, man. It's an amazing guitar. Just amazing. It's the low string is a B, and you tune down to A, and you play on it, and you're like, suddenly the room changes. You're in Seattle. It's raining. Life is miserable and good as it can possibly be. You know, it's like, it's so heavy. It's and beautiful. You can capo it up and get you know, great, more traditional 12-string stuff. Big body, big sound, but that's a lot of fun. I'll bring it by. You gotta check this guitar out.
Yeah, it sounds great. I never heard of something like that, but boy, it's I love baritone guitars, first of all, but a baritone 12-string, wow, I can just imagine. How easy is or difficult is it to get strings for it?
I haven't had to restring it yet.
Good.
And I've got a set of strings. They Martin put out some strings, so. But it's been on. You know, I left it with Joe Perry for the last Aerosmith record. I was showing it to Jack Douglas, and I showed it to Joe and Steven actually one day when I was standing there talking some mics with them, and he's like, "Wow, man, can I just hang on to this a bit?" And so it was in there, and I'm not even sure what they use it on, but Jack Douglas said they used it on a couple of songs. And then it went and sat on a Maroon 5 session for a while, too, because the producer's a good friend of mine, Noah Passavoy. So I left it there. And I don't know if they use it on the record or not, but Adam grabbed it the minute I brought it in and started playing on it, you know, Adam Levine.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Wow, this is cool." And it is. It's just one of those really fun guitars. So for a while there, I was kind of letting friends hang on to it, especially if it was going to maybe get a little airtime on an album, you know, that I thought was going to be good. But I think I'll keep it at home now because it's just, I miss it when it's gone.
Yeah.
And I'll bring it by and let you check it out. That's super cool guitar. Another one that I love is a Martin D35 that kind of like from the early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
That has been wonderful. And then electric wise, you know, I've got a couple of Strats and I've got a Les Paul 60s reissue that I really like. But there's one surprising guitar that I end up playing more than anything. It's between this Strat and this particular guitar. I'm not a big fan of Paul Reed Smith guitars because just tonally they kind of seemed to, and I'm not knocking the line at all. They're amazingly well-built guitars, and I've seen some players get some great tones. But to me, I could never really get a sound that I wanted out of it. I always seem to get more authentic tones through my Strat or through my Les Paul. But there's a Dave Grissom model that is just amazing. And it sits right next to the Les Paul, and I can barely tell the difference.
Okay.
It's got a floating tremolo. And the thing I always battle, I really like trems. I really like, and I like to work the tremolo fairly hard. You know, I was an 80s player with the Floyd Rose thing going on.
Yeah.
You could do octave bombs and come right back into tune.
Yeah.
And I really like sort of Becky-ish, you know, work with the tremolo too, which is something I miss with the hardtail Les Paul. So this Paul Reed Smith, this Dave Grissom model, is so close to the Les Paul. I brought this one by Joe Barisi's place, and he's not a PRS fan at all. And he was playing on the thing for 10 or 15 minutes, and I've even got him on video. Go, man, this is one of the best guitars I've ever played.
No kidding. Who would have thought?
Yeah, sounds great. You can trim the hell out of it and bring it right back into tune.
Wow.
And so that's a wonderful guitar, and I play that almost every day. Just pick it up and noodle on it or plug it in. And you know, sometimes I'll pull the Paul out and bang on that thing. And the Strat is always around because it's a great guitar to just practice on when you're sitting around and keep your fingers working. It makes you work a little harder, and that's always good.
Boy, I wish I would do that. Now, once upon a time, I'd do that every chance I got, and now it's few and far between. Now,
chances that often. I'll tell you one last thing that I'm going to do. This was surprised the heck out of me. I'm pulling a blank. Great guitarist. He's going to kill me. He's a friend of mine too, but great player. Anyway, I was on a session with him where he was playing a stock Strat that he paid $300 for. Then put some new pickups in. And he was tremoloing the heck out of this thing, and it just it stayed in tune. And I grabbed it from him later, killing it, and it popped back into tune all the time. It was a setup that he had that he's put out on some videos, and it works incredibly. You can take any Strat and get that thing to stay in tune perfectly.
Interesting.
Amazing.
Can you send me a link to that if you think of it?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, before we get off this, I'm going to dig up his name. He's on our first demo CD, Royer's first demo CD, some of his blues tracks.
Okay, last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you ever received from someone or that you learned?
I think that the best business advice I ever learned from someone was an accountant who I was talking to about a company that didn't work out. And one of the reasons it didn't work out was because one of the people I was involved with was turned out to not be as honest as I would have hoped. And the guy says, "Hey, you've learned the most important thing." He goes, "If you have the trust, you have everything. If you don't have the trust, you have nothing." And he had advised me against getting into this company originally because of his feelings about the overall structure of things. But he goes, "You know, you didn't lose much, and you know, now you learn the most important thing," which was really, really a wonderful piece of advice. And it's one of the great things about Royer. The people that I work with are highly ethical folks who are driven and really quality oriented. And we don't always agree on things. I mean, Rick Parada and myself have really had to duke it out over a number of things over the years, but I really trust the guy, and I know his heart's always in the right place, and that means a whole lot. So you want to work with people not always that you agree with, because you want to bring their ideas to the table, and you know, oftentimes you have to, you know, admit later, you know, that their ideas are better, or maybe yours are better, and you have to find that place in the middle where you can come together. But work with people you trust. If you have trust issues, either work them out or move on, because those will really sting you.
So great words of wisdom. It's a good place to stop. Thanks so much, John. I appreciate you being with me today. This is great. I knew it was going to be great. I wish we could actually spend a little more time,
but yeah, me too.
but it was very cool. But we will talk soon.
Great. Thanks. Really appreciate it, Bobby. Thanks so much.
If you want to find out more about John, go to royerlabs.com. That's R-O-Y-E-R, royerlabs.com. And you can click the About Us tab, and you'll find a lot more about John and about Royer Labs. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. He's the one who puts this all together. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll also find a sign-up sheet for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.